Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief, and welcome to the month of November. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting this week from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Today, on the heels of the Values Voters Summit, two authors are wondering why a new generation of young Americans holds an overwhelmingly negative perception of Christianity. We're going to ask them why. Plus, with Mormonism increasingly in the news, we'll hear from a person who decided it was time to gather some of the nation's best religious thinkers for a conference on the impact of the Mormon faith. And why does presidential candidate Mike Huckabee think there are so many immigrants in the American workforce?
It might be because for the last 35 years, we have aborted more than a million people who would have been in our workforce.
But first, what's the connection between faith leaders and the nominee for attorney general? The answer is found in one word: torture. Retired federal judge Michael Mukasey, who is President Bush's pick for the nation's top law enforcement position, hit a snag in his confirmation hearings this past week. Everything seemed to be going well, but the sticking point now is a refusal to equate the interrogation technique known as waterboarding with torture. Critics see this equivocation as a safeguard for the U.S. government, leaving open the possibility of using the technique on detainees without crossing moral and legal boundaries. Now, for the record, here's the definition of waterboarding as provided to ABC News by unnamed CIA sources. Quoting, "The prisoner is bound to an inclined board, feet raised and head slightly below the feet. Cellophane is wrapped over the prisoner's face and water is poured over him. Unavoidably, the gag reflex kicks in, and a terrifying fear of drowning leads to almost instant pleas to bring the treatment to a halt." Now, with that information so easily available, and you know it's easily available if we have it here on State of Belief, it's puzzling that Mukasey says he doesn't know the details of how waterboarding is conducted. Well, then again, maybe it isn't so puzzling. Similarly, it shouldn't be seen as coincidental that Mukasey's confirmation hearings have coincided with a renewed push for a faith-based response to U.S.-sponsored torture. The National Religious Campaign Against Torture, formed in January of 2006, and now consists of more than 130 religious groups representing many Christian, Jewish, Muslim, and Sikh faith traditions. Linda Gustitis is the president of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture. She joins us now on the phone from Iowa to tell us about a new initiative being championed by more than 500 congregations across the country. Linda, welcome to State of Belief.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
Tell us why this organization formed.
Well, NERCAT was, we call it NERCAT, it's the acronym. The National Religious Campaign Against Torture was formed about 2 years ago out of the belief that it was the religious community that needed to step up and say no to U.S.-sponsored torture. After the pictures from Abu Ghraib and the release of more and more information about what we were doing to our detainees, it was incumbent upon the religious community, people of faith, to stand up and say, this is wrong, it's immoral, and it's illegal under all circumstances.
Now, this new initiative, I think, is called Spotlight on Torture. What do you hope to accomplish by this?
Well, first of all, NERCAT is an organization, by the way, of all faiths. We have Christians, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists. It's an interfaith organization. And what we're trying to do is educate congregations across the country as to the issue of torture. It's now, you know, over the last few days, because of the nomination of the Attorney General, it's particularly getting the attention of the American people. But up till now, it's something that people don't like to talk about. And we want to bring it to the forefront in order to stop it. And so what we're doing is trying to educate our congregations on what the United States has been doing, what torture is, and why we need to stop it completely. So we organized an event, which is called Spotlight on Torture, to show the movie Ghosts of Abu Ghraib, which is just about what it says. It's about what happened at Abu Ghraib, to show that documentary in 500 congregations across the country of different denominations and different faiths.
Now, are you trying to also motivate people to write their member of Congress? What other kinds of action?
Oh, yes. We're asking people to get involved, to step up and let their members of Congress, their community, their friends, their family know what the United States has been doing with respect to torture and that we must stop it. And to stop it, we need to enact legislation. Legislation was enacted about 2 years ago. It was called the McCain Amendment to try to stop torture. And it was effective with respect to the military, actually. But there's a big hole with respect to the Central Intelligence Agency and the CIA, and that's where this kind of conduct is going on. So we need legislation to stop the what they call enhanced interrogation techniques, which we call torture, to close secret prisons, and to stop what we call rendition for torture, which is where we take our detainees and we send them to countries knowing that they will be tortured there.
You know, it's hard to believe that people supposedly smart enough to be leaders in this nation don't understand what torture is. I understand you recently questioned Rudy Giuliani there in Iowa about the specific issue of waterboarding. I wonder, what did his answer tell you about how our leaders and those who want to become our leaders are treating this issue?
Well, it's very dispiriting, I must say. Mr. Giuliani, when I asked him, does he think waterboarding is torture, said, well, he wasn't sure. It depends upon the circumstances. He said, well, if it's defined one way, it would be, but if it's defined another way, it wouldn't be. And those of us who are familiar and educated about this issue know without a doubt that waterboarding is torture. Senator John McCain has said so. Actually, Lindsey Graham has said so, Senator Graham. Those of us who follow this issue know unequivocally that waterboarding is torture.
Why is the American public tolerating this?
Well, there are people, and including our president, who say, first of all, he doesn't call it torture. So he says we don't torture, but we do. And they say it works. So their argument is we have to keep doing this in order to protect the American people. And the answer to that is, from a faith-based perspective, torture is wrong regardless of whether it works or not. But if you even address the issue of whether it works, the truth of the matter is many, many people say it doesn't work. And the other point is that we don't know, even if it may work in one particular circumstance, there may be other techniques that would have worked better. The FBI tells us that seducing somebody, getting them to trust you, is the way to get information, not torturing them.
Linda Gastaldis is the president of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture. We've got more information about this organization and the initiative Spotlight on Torture at stateofbelief.com. Go there and look it up and find out more. Linda, thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, we were tired of everyone telling us who is and who is not a values voter. So we took a poll of our own to find out what people value when it comes to religion and politics. And we want to tell you what we found. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief on Air America Radio.
The Interfaith Alliance, defending democratic values and promoting religious liberty. Learn more at interfaithalliance.org.
So glad I got good religion. So glad I got good religion.
And now, the wit and wisdom of Pat Robertson, as State of Belief presents another installment of In Their Own Words.
Like it or not, Halloween has been made as a festival for the devil, and it was a time of calling on evil spirits. And for Christians to participate in this, it is not just a costume party. It is something that has a much deeper significance. Why do you think people dress up as ghouls and goblins and skeletons and so forth? It's because that is the origin of Halloween. And so for Christians to participate in it is wrong.
And that's In Their Own Words, here on State of Belief.
Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. Yes, yes, yes. That was our good friend, Pat Robertson. I think I'll just let his comment stand alone. But you know what? Right there is another difference between the religious right and the Interfaith Alliance. While Pat Robertson is busy warning about the spiritual dangers of trick or treating, we're paying attention to how religion is likely to influence the next presidential election. Last week, the Interfaith Alliance Foundation sponsored a survey conducted by the polling agency Greenberg Quinlan Rosner to find out how voters view the role of religion in politics as we head into one of the most wide-open presidential races in our history. With me right now to discuss the poll results and what they mean is the press secretary for the Interfaith Alliance and a familiar voice on State of Belief, William Blake. William, welcome back.
Thanks. It's good to be here again.
Now, if you will, hit the important numbers for us that emerged in this poll.
The poll that the Interfaith Alliance sponsored through our First Freedom First project paints a picture that demonstrates just how strong a support there is out there for our First Freedom amongst the American people. And what we found from a number of different questions was that when it comes to making up your decision of who to vote for as a voter, that voters want to make that decision independent of politicians trumpeting their personal religion and independent of what their pastors or religious leaders tell them in houses of worship. We asked the question, do you agree with the statement that presidential candidates should not use their religion or faith to influence voters to support them? And 68% of respondents answered that they did agree with that statement, including actually 60% of people who attend religious services on a regular basis. We also asked how much influence should religious leaders and clergy have on voters' decision. Only 8.5% of respondents said that religious leaders should have a great deal of influence, whereas people who said that religious leaders should have not much influence or no influence at all numbered at about 58%.
Did this go across political party lines?
Actually, yes. The number of Democrats, self-identified Democrats who said that religious leaders should have a great deal of influence in their voting decision was only 9%, and Republicans, it was only 9%. There wasn't much difference based on party affiliation or how often the people in the survey attend religious services. Another interesting finding from the survey is that once the next president is selected and the next vacancy on the Supreme Court comes about, 78% of the American people have said that they want the next justice on the Supreme Court to protect the separation of religion and government. And again, that comes across party lines, including 68% of Republicans.
Now, folks, don't miss the bottom line here. A majority of the American people want to protect religious freedom, our first freedom, in the midst of hotly contested races for each major political party's nominee for the president of the United States. And, as William said, voters are telling us they don't want anybody telling them how to vote. Now, for me personally, this polling data came like a breath of fresh air, rushing into a room in which support for the First Amendment seemed in such short supply that religious freedom was in danger of a last gasp of breath. I am proud of these American voters. And as William pointed out, a significant number of these people who attend houses of worship regularly also support the final bottom line conclusions. Don't use religion as a strategy. Let us make up our own minds. They understand the First Amendment to the Constitution and the free exercise of religion or restraint from it. You know, it's always interesting to take a look at these polls and compare them to sensibilities in the past. And it almost always shows an evolving awareness on both sides of the political spectrum when it comes to the relationship between religion and politics. We noticed a similar focus on these changing attitudes in an article, a wonderful article by David Kirkpatrick in last week's New York Times Magazine. The piece was entitled "The Evangelical Crackup," and it sparked a lot of conversation about the future of evangelical Christianity, specifically in terms of ties to the Republican Party. Here's a section of the article that stuck with us. Listen. A younger generation of evangelicals are pushing the movement and its theology to new directions. There are many ways to characterize the split, but the result is a new interest in public policies that address problems of peace, health, and poverty, problems unlike abortion and same-sex marriage, where left and right compete to present the best answers. Well, that split is even more clearly defined by David Kinnaman and Gabe Lyons, two researchers who discovered an overwhelmingly negative perception of Christianity by young people. We'll find out the details next. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio. Do you care about America's religious freedom? I do. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance Foundation. I invite you to renew your commitment to protecting America's religious liberty. See our new project online at firstfreedomfirst.org. Read the petition and sign it. Then ask someone else to sign it. We will present your signatures to elected officials asking that religious liberty remain a significant part of the policy debate. The website is firstfreedomfirst.org. We need your signature. Together, we can protect religious freedom.
State of Belief once a week, not enough? Check out our website, stateofbelief.com.
Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. When the research organization, the Barna Group, tried to find out what Christianity means to young people living in America, these were some of the most common one-word answers: hypocritical, insincere, anti-homosexual, sheltered, judgmental. Indeed, for many Americans aged 16 to 29, Christianity is most clearly defined by what it is against. The conclusions of this research, along with a thorough examination of its implications, can be found in the new book called Unchristian: What a New Generation Really Thinks About Christianity and Why It Matters. The authors of the book are Dave Kinnaman, president of the Barna Group, and Gabe Lyons. Dave and Gabe are joining us by phone right now to tell us more. Gentlemen, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you, Reverend Gaddy, for having us.
I have followed the Barna Group's work for many years, and I remember 10 years ago, the Barna Group released a report showing that Christianity had a strong, positive image in America. What's happened?
Yeah, I remember actually writing that press release when I first started at the company, and we found at that particular time that the majority of Americans, even those who were not themselves Christians, felt very favorably about the influence of Christianity in culture. And over the last 10 years, and I think we've really seen a major shift over the last 10 years, where particularly with young people, there is a growing sense of disenchantment, of frustration, of feeling hostile and sort of rejecting Christianity because of many of their perceptions and many of their experiences while they were in church themselves.
And what did that? I mean, what were the agendas or the items or the words that turned them off?
Well, each person has a very different kind of answer to that question, and we actually did more than 10,000 interviews throughout the course of this project over the last 3 years and a bunch of interviews with 16 to 29-year-olds. You could make the argument that some people were influenced by media, by negative portrayals of Christianity, but more significantly, we found that it was often a very specific conversation that they had had with a pastor or with a Christian, or it was some experience that they had had within the church that had given them a sense that, you know, Christianity is all of those negative words that you used. It's hypocritical and judgmental and sheltered. That they had come away with a negative opinion that it wasn't the kind of faith that they wanted to be associated with.
Now, I'm curious, are the negative impressions of Christianity by many of these young people coming from young people who are not Christians, or is it coming from people who are Christians themselves?
Well, the majority of the people that, when you look at the research and the perceptions that come back that we point out in the book on Christian, that Christians are anti-homosexual, that 91% believe that, 87% believe that Christians are judgmental, 75% that Christians are too political. Those responses are specifically from non-Christians, or as we call them in the book, outsiders. And then we did the same research on Christians, and what was also somewhat surprising was that Christians held similar views. I mean, when you looked at the anti-homosexual claim, 91% of non-Christians believe that. 80% of Christians believe that also accurately represented Christianity and Christians today. And when you look down the line, Christians tended to trail 20 to 30 points depending on the topic. But both were surveyed. But we try to really emphasize in this project, what do non-Christians think of Christians? Because we think it's so important that we hold the mirror up and really look at what people think about Christians and see if that's consistent with who Jesus was and who Jesus has called us to be.
We had found that, you know, again, as Gabe was talking about, the fact that young people both inside and outside the church have these perceptions. And one of the arguments that we set forth and one of the real surprises for us over the last 3 years was the fact that you had so many people within the church with young churchgoers. For instance, it's half of those individuals, 50%, who say they believe the church has become too political. And it was a real surprise to us to see the number of times that young churchgoers and young committed Christians had some of these same kind of negative experiences and perspectives. And that really led us to believe it was really sort of the first clue to us that it isn't just an image problem among outsiders, those that are looking at Christianity from the outside in, as much as it is a substance problem that we have to go back and really go back and think through how does Christianity affect the young people that we're discipling and growing and trying to train to be like Jesus.
Now, you all say that young people see Christianity as a brand rather than as a faith. What does that mean?
Well, it's really just an illustration that when you look at the brands of our world today, think of Starbucks or Nike, when people and teenagers, especially 20-somethings, see a brand or have an experience with a product, they immediately call up into their mind images, past experiences, thoughts, interactions that they had with that product or interactions they had at that particular environment. So I use Starbucks as an example. When somebody hears the word Starbucks, they probably think about the aroma that they have when they're in Starbucks. They might think about the comfortable chairs or a nice greeting in the morning from a barista. But when they hear the word Christian, or when they're, for instance, a college student walking down his dorm hall says to another college student at the beginning of their freshman year, "Yeah, you know, my name's John and I'm a Christian," the instant thoughts and the top-of-mind perceptions that come to mind are these perceptions, that Christians are anti-homosexual, that we're hypocritical, that we're sheltered, unintelligent. And so the comparison to the brand is simply meant to say that we need to understand that people have perceptions. They have them about everything in life, and they have perceptions about Christianity. And the more that we can get to know what those are, the more it will cause us to look inward to figure out what's going on with our own faith and where have we gone wrong in this case.
On this show, State of Belief, we do a lot of talk about what's happening at the intersection of religion and politics. In fact, we were just talking about the changing attitudes that Americans have when it comes to religion and politics. I'm curious about the young people. How do young people perceive the influence of Christianity in American politics?
Well, I think what they do is they look at both the spokespeople for the faith as well as the lives of the people in their neighborhood and in the churches that they've attended, and they say that by and large they see the political activism of Christians to be feisty, to be polarizing, to be arrogant, to come across as though Christians are experts at a wide range of issues, and yet they don't seem to offer compassionate, informed, solution-oriented kind of answers to those kinds of things. And that's really where we've come, as we've been studying this. Our big issue and our big response is not simply to critique Christians in the public square or in politics, but to suggest that as young people are saying, we need a different kind of experience. We want people that really say what they mean and mean what they say and actually do something about the problems, that Christians ought to be redefined and rethinking their approaches to politics so that the negative images, so that some of this, these barriers to really having a dialogue and learning from one another, to not have an us versus them perspective, but one in which there's a lot of willingness to share common ground. And again, to be defined by our relationships and our compassion for some of the problems that people are facing.
I happen to be a Christian minister myself, and I'm asking this question, I guess, in relation to my colleagues. As you all unfold this data, what kind of response are you getting from religious leaders in the Christian community? Is it, thank you for opening our eyes, or is it, you all must have talked to the wrong people?
Well, I think we've been met with both reactions, but in large part, people are responding and saying, we've kind of had intuition that this was the sense that people felt this way, but we've never seen it this clearly, so this is really helpful. And many leaders are responding in that way and saying, how do we go about the great work of seeing a major shift occur so that we can have different perceptions about us if we were to do the same kind of research in 30 years. So even the book itself has contributions from 30 different leaders that represent very different views maybe on things from theology to politics to social issues. But they came together to say in one voice, look, it's about time for the church to get back to the basics of living out our faith, to demonstrating it, and that with this next generation, it's going to take a real purification of our faith and a demonstration of our faith that will speak many more volumes than all the words we can put to people as to what the Christian faith's about.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, and I certainly don't want to oversimplify, so challenge me if I do that. But I'm wondering, are you saying to the Christian community that the one corrective that is most important to make at this point has to do with authenticity and integrity? And I mean by that consistency between words and actions or between belief and behavior.
Yeah, I think that's a really wise way of putting it. And, one of the as a sociologist and as a researcher, I'm studying the state of Christianity and the state of spirituality in America all the time. And what we find is that, the huge majority of Americans describe themselves as Christians. In fact, more than 7 out of 10 Americans say they've made a commitment to Christ in the past. And essentially what we've concluded in this whole project is that we really need, a deeper expression of what it means to be Christian, a greater amount of respect for people of other faiths, a greater willingness to give sacrificially. We need more volunteerism. We need people, going outside of this country and serving the needs of the global community. And really at the core of it is to be willing to listen and listen to people that are our critics. And, as you talk about authenticity and transparency, to be like Christ, the whole term unchristian actually comes from the interviews where people said, we don't think that Christianity in present-day America is what Jesus intended, and we don't see Jesus in you. And in order for that picture to be reversed at a fundamental level, we have to go back to seeing what Jesus' ministry was all about, which was pursuing people in the margins, working with people that everyone else judged him for. And yet he said he was here to set the captives free and to bring sight to the blind. And so as Christians, we've got to be very willing to do that kind of thing, to be authentic in our pursuit of, you know, sacrificing our lives just like Jesus did for the pursuit of other people.
Our guests have been David Kinnaman and Gabe Lyons. They are authors of a fabulous new book called Unchristian: What a New Generation Really Thinks About Christianity and Why It Matters. David and Gabe, thank you so much for being with us and spending time with us on State of Belief.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
Up next, polls show Mitt Romney and Mike Huckabee doing well in the caucus state of Iowa, but it's not their poll numbers that has us paying attention to them this week. I'm Welton Gaddy. I'll tell you more about that in just a moment. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio. This is State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. Just 2 weeks ago, there was a Values Voters Summit here in Washington, D.C. We talked about the event here on last week's show and gave you an idea of what's on the mind of these so-called values voters. But two candidates for president appeared to be on the minds of our national media in the days following the summit. For Mitt Romney, nearly every minute of airtime or drop of ink devoted to his appearance made mention of his success with the summit crowd despite his Mormon faith. Their words, not mine. For the past year, Mitt Romney has been considered a serious candidate for the presidency. And although you can't get through a news report without a mention of Mormonism, there's been virtually no attempt to understand a faith that is still quite unfamiliar to many Americans. Melissa Proctor is hoping to correct that problem. She's a lecturer at Harvard Divinity School and has organized the Conference on Mormonism and American Politics at Princeton University. Conference kicks off on Friday, November 9th, and we're happy to have Melissa with us right now to tell us about it. Melissa, welcome to State of Belief.
Thanks so much.
What made you organize this Conference on Mormonism?
Well, I wanted to facilitate an interdisciplinary conversation that would bring together historians, political scientists, philosophers, legal scholars, journalists, all the people that are sort of talking about Mitt Romney's run for the presidency.
If someone said, are you doing this to advance Romney's popularity, what would you say?
Oh, It's an interesting question. A number of the people on the panels actually are not experts in Mormonism at all. The idea behind the conference is really to talk about larger questions, the place of religion in the public square, the intersection between religion and politics, and Mormonism is sort of a case study for some of those questions.
I see. Well, so what will be the focus of the panels at the conference? What subjects will you cover?
There will be four separate panels that will explore the earliest encounters of Mormonism in American politics, and on that panel are historians. The second panel will look at Mormonism as a case study for church-state issues, and we have political scientists on that panel. The third panel will look at Mormonism in the media. The media has made a lot of Mitt's Mormonism, and so we've invited a number of journalists to come and talk to us about that. The fourth panel will look at the role religious identity plays in the public square, and I've invited a number of noted public intellectuals from a variety of faith traditions to come and talk about that for us, including Richard Land, Francis Beckwith, Alan Wolfe, and Thomas Griffith.
Again, the Conference on Mormonism and Politics at Princeton University begins Friday, November 9th. It's free. It's open to the public. Melissa Proctor, thanks for previewing it with us today on State of Belief.
Thanks, Reverend Gaddy.
Now, the other candidate who walked away with quite a bit of media attention from the Values Voters Summit was Mike Huckabee. He was hailed in headlines as the one true hope for evangelical voters in this election. And he's positioned to be a major upset candidate in the Iowa caucuses. But something that received very little notice from the media was this comment regarding illegal immigration. Listen.
Sometimes we talk about why are we importing so many people in our workforce. It might be because for the last 35 years, we have aborted more than a million people who would have been in our workforce had we not had the Holocaust of liberalized abortion under a flawed Supreme Court ruling in 1973.
Now, why was that not in the mainstream media? Well, comments like that don't go unnoticed by us, even if they go unnoticed by others. Look, it's a complete distortion and borderline unethical to imply that the amount of abortions in this country has something to do with the amount of immigrant labor the U.S. employs. All Huckabee is doing is speaking the code language of the religious right as he continues to shape himself in the way the media has already ordained as the only proper Christian candidate in the race. Now remember this comment the next time someone tells you the religious right is dead. It's not. Remember the sounds of applause and the cheers that accompanied this comment. The religious right is alive. Remember that there are still issues that can be exploited in a heartbeat in order to turn out a conservative Christian voting bloc for Republican candidates. Don't you forget it. Remember all of that as we head into 2008. Well, that's our show for this week. If you want to respond to anything you heard today, go to the Contact Us page at stateofbelief.com and send us an email or call us at 212-871-8280. That's 212-871-8280. State of Belief is produced by the Interfaith Alliance Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Members of the Interfaith Alliance make this show possible. So if you like what you've heard, if you like this show, think about becoming a member of the Interfaith Alliance. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. Next week, we'll talk to a man who's attempting to, in his words, unravel the mystery of his Jewish father's Nazi boyhood. Well, he has us intrigued. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and that's State of Belief.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.